Good morning, Dr. Lou. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning.
Glad to have you. I know that it's been a really busy week for you, and I'd like to just kind of approach it this way, if we could. Tell us some of the key things that you think were accomplished and what you think still needs to be done. And you've got 10 minutes to do it, of course, all right? So, and then let me ask you a few questions about what I think needs to be done, if in your recollection here or your recounting of what's going on, something's kind of left out. Is that fair enough, Chris?
Sure, we can do that, and I'll run through a quick laundry list, and then I know there's some things that are of particular interest to you and your listeners, and we can chat about those too.
Okay.
One of my big priorities is this concept of taxation without representation. We have cities and municipalities around the state that tax, police, and regulate folks outside of municipal limits. This is a pretty big deal. You know, we fought a little war about this in 1776, and I've been trying to unravel that for some time.
Right.
We're closer to getting that done than before. This is Senate Bill 107. It's passed out of the Senate, 30-0, got down to the House, and is in committee now in the House. I expect it to be back out of committee next week and hopefully on the floor the following week. But this is another one of those things where, you know, government is expanding and continues to expand its reach, and it is really closest to home at the local level. So these are municipal ordinances that tell you what you can and can't do with your land, and how you can do it and how you can't do it, and everything from leash laws to dust ordinances to sign ordinances to wetland ordinances, etc.
Right.
And these municipalities love influence in that area outside their city, and you've got no recourse at the ballot box.
Well, you know, you're exactly right about that.
Wrong.
Exactly right, because we had people who were forced to pay property tax increases over education, which is a different issue. But the point is, those property taxes, they couldn't vote on those issues out of Spanish Ford and Fairhope. So you're absolutely right that there is a no taxation without representation, you know, issue here.
Well, and we're trying to fix that and phase it out over time. I think we're in a good place to do that. But if your listeners can call their House members and tell them that you support SB 107, I think it would help significantly. I'll move on to another topic and say that so far we have been fairly successful in keeping this gambling bill, this expansive gambling bill, at bay. I am in support of a lottery. I think a number of my constituents, the vast majority of my constituents, are in support of a lottery. But what we have before us is a lottery on steroids, right? It's all kinds of gaming and gambling. It is a special interest boondoggle, and I'm just not in favor of that. I'd like to see a clean lottery bill, but what we have before us now is no good. We've been successful in delaying its floor action on it for a number of weeks, but I think that's coming to an end, and it's going to be time for folks to vote on it. And I'm a no vote on that right now, and don't see that changing.
Well, let me ask you this just quickly: what can we do to help you with that? I mean, I think I heard you say on Sean's show that, you know, why not just have three separate bills that deal with the issues of gaming, one, and then the lottery bill, and then something else that I think was involved with it. But is that a reasonable approach to this, and just kind of take it out of the hands of one big omnibus bill like that?
Sure, that's a reasonable approach, but the reason it's all tied up is because the, you know, pro gambling interests want to make sure it's tied up and one's tied to the other. That's exactly why it's done like this, is so that folks that are in favor of a lottery, like I am, will be forced to take a vote on this wide expansive of gaming. Again, you know, this bill allows stuff that you can't even do in Las Vegas, and I'm not sure, you know, Alabama's ready for that.
Right.
But I can't decouple it right now, so the best thing to do is to vote against it, and then maybe we can get a bill on the floor that actually gives the people the right to vote on just what everybody seems to want anyway.
Is there such a bill, just lottery only?
There has been in the past. Senator Albritton's had that bill in the past. It would be an easy thing to resurrect and get on the floor. I do think we've got to deal with this other piece of legislation first. I'm hopeful that it meets its demise here shortly, and then we can get on to getting the people what they actually want to look at.
Okay. Okay. What was next on your list?
The next big thing, and I'll go back to Senator Albritton again, has a very good bill that deals with dips and dunks. These are the probation violations which land a criminal back in jail. They're supposed to serve that time in the state penitentiary, and right now the state is putting that burden back down on counties. There are over 4,000 state inmates currently housed in county facilities around the state, and the counties are bearing the burden of those inmates and are having to pay for those inmates. It's expensive, Lou, and it's coming out of your pocket as a taxpayer here in Baldwin County in particular, and other bigger counties where they simply can't afford it, and that burden needs to be at the state level as opposed to at the county level.
Let me just ask you quickly, I was under the impression that some of the county jails that have space actually rent that space out to either our state or other states. Is that still going on, or are we just so overcrowded now because of the prison issue itself that, like you said, you've got 4,000 of these people who are now being housed at the county level. Is there really a space problem at the county level?
It is a space problem at the county level. The county sheriffs have been pretty sharp, and our sheriff in Baldwin County, Hoss Mack, has been pretty sharp. If he has additional space to lease it out to the feds, they use it for ICE, for instance, where they've got illegal immigrants that they need to put on a hold. They can do that at the Baldwin County facility, and the sheriff gets compensated for that, or more specifically, the county does. In the case of state inmates, this governor is using the pandemic to justify the housing of over 4,000 at county jails without compensation to the counties currently, and that's a problem. I mean, this is another example of a wide abuse, in my opinion, of these emergency health orders to do things that is well outside of pandemic response.
Right.
And that's what's happening to a lot of counties here, is the governor's using what she deems is her emergency powers to do this. So Senator Albritton's bill will address that. It's out of the Senate, and the House will have to decide to concur on that bill. But that's one for your folks to watch. Then we go right into these other bills, the constitutional amendment that allows the legislature to call itself back into session. Is a bill that is moving through the Senate currently. We'll have it in Governmental Affairs Committee, which I'm vice chairman of here tomorrow, actually. And I am anxious to get that one back in. That really puts that separation of powers back into place and gives us a check on some of the governor's authority.
What's the number?
In the most extreme of circumstances, but I think you would agree we're probably in some of those extreme circumstances now with this this self-perpetuating, never-ending, year-long state of emergency.
What are the numbers on the Albritton bill and the one you just mentioned about the legislators coming back in?
Lou, you'll have to forgive me. I don't have those in front of me right now.
Okay.
I can't keep them all in my head.
Okay. Listen, at least you know what you're talking about. I'm still trying to figure out, the lay of the land on some of these things. I mean, because there is so much. It is impossible to keep track of it. But I think that you just mentioned those two that are particularly important. And, you mentioned, executive power and all like that. Is SB 97, the Whatley bill, is that moving along? Because I know that there are some real issues about it, but can you mention that and tell me what you think about that?
Yeah, that one's another one that really looks at checking power. In that instance, it's trying to move that power from an unelected bureaucrat, who's a nice guy, don't get me wrong, but the public health officer, back to where there's at least some accountability to an elected official. That bill puts some checks on that. It requires the governor to actually sign off on any health orders that are done, instead of just allowing a public health official to close businesses like he did about a year ago with his sole discretion. That's very concerning to myself and a number of colleagues, and we need to get that fixed so that at least there's a an elected official that has to sign off on that, and then, of course, be ultimately accountable to the voters. Currently, he's not accountable to the voters in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and that's a scary place to be constitutionally.
Right. Now, did that bill actually rename the public health thing into something else? I mean, it seems like it was a little bit broader than just trying to check the executive branch's power.
Yeah, Senator Wiley's does not. That bill that we were talking about just requires the governor to sign off on them. There's another bill that Senator McClendon has that requires the public health officer to be a cabinet-level official and an appointee of the governor. They're essentially trying to accomplish the same thing, and that is to ultimately make the governor or some other, an elected official ultimately responsible for the public health, as opposed to this unelected bureaucrat being responsible for it on their own. So two separate bills with a similar goal in mind, and it remains to be seen which one of them will actually matriculate.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but which one would you be more in favor of?
You know, I think that Senator McClendon's bill is probably a better one. I've been supportive of Senator Wiley's in concept.
Yeah.
I think moving this whole notion of public health as a cabinet-level official is probably a good thing. Now, there are certainly detractors, and they'll tell you, no, we need somebody that's independent when we're looking at public health, and that shouldn't be subject to politics. I'm sorry, but everything's subject to politics.
Yeah.
And when we're not taking into account the people's voice and having a politician that's got their tail on the line when it comes election time, that's how we provide a check and a balance. That's how the people make sure their voice is heard, is if they're worried about not getting elected again. And
right.
I want to make sure we continue to have your voice being heard in as many different places as possible.
Yeah, well, you know, that goes hand in hand with the whole idea of having judges, you know, voted on. I mean, there are a lot of states that don't have that. They follow the Missouri approach to things. But the reality is that if these judges have to run, then they have to be, you know, accountable in some way. And the only other way is impeaching them or something along those lines, which doesn't really happen very often, at least. So, Chris, I mean, I think that
I'll agree with you.
Yeah. All right. So I know there are a couple of other big bills that you want to talk about. So why don't you mention them before I ask you a couple of other questions?
Well, I think that probably hits most of them. You know, of course, we've got the budgets coming up. Those are always interesting. There's a bill that passed the Senate that really increases access to public to broadband, and would spend an awful lot of money on broadband access, which I think is laudable. But I do have concerns about it, and I expressed that on the floor the other day during the floor debate, that we are getting into heavily subsidizing the end user of broadband, and it's starting to smell to me an awful like those, you know, free government cell phones that some people have. I'm all for access and making sure that we encourage access, but I get real concerned when I see these government handouts continuing to expand. It sounds like a good thing, but at some point you got to decide, hey, is this a key function of government? And if not, maybe we ought not to be spending money on it.
Yeah, well, I completely agree with that. I do think that the big question about broadband access, according to what I read with this, they had the Parker discussion about this, and I guess 1 in 4 Alabamians don't have access, but that's different than, you know, not having something that you can use, which, again, you're back to that whole free telephone business. So I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me that you're on the right track with that if you can, you know, move them in a different direction. But I do think that the broadband question should be addressed, and there are a couple of other things that they have done with it. But I think the fund that you're talking about, funding, goes into one of these broadband funds, if I'm not mistaken. But again, that's an issue that should be addressed if we possibly can, I would argue. But let me ask you this. This, I think it's SB 46. It's the marijuana bill. Where is that, and what are your thoughts on that one? Because I know that API was pretty much against it for a lot of good reasons, in my view. But how do we square what seems to be a medical need with this without creating a monster organization as this gaming bill, I mean the marijuana bill seems to do. What's your sense of that?
That's a great question, and Lou, it's a concern that I share. It's just not a concern I've got a solution for. I wish I did.
Yeah.
So I want folks that are in severe medical situations, chronic pain, you think about, you know, cancer patients, chemotherapy yeah. patients that are at end of life, having situations like that. Of course, you and your listeners know, my family has gone through some of those situations personally, so I'm pretty sensitive to that. I will just say we want to make sure they've got access to something like that, to medical marijuana, in lieu of these harsh opiates that sometimes can have these horrible, horrible side effects up to and including lifelong addiction.
Right.
If we can get them the meds that their doctor can prescribe, I'm in favor of that. But we've got to tightly control it to make sure that it's not abused, and I think everybody would agree with that too. But I will say that I share your concerns and share API's concerns as well, that in order to control and tightly control, that we've created a new government bureaucracy, which is something I don't like doing.
Yeah.
So I'm open to thoughts on how do we get people medicine that they need in the very few circumstances when they're in end-of-life scenarios or chronic, you know, cancer patients, etc. But how do we do so without creating a government bureaucracy to oversee it? And Lou, I'll tell you, I've got an answer for a lot of things, but in this case, I'm not sure how to do both, and I'd be welcome to your thoughts on it.
Yeah, maybe we can try to do a town hall. I know, you know, listen, we're finally having our first planning committee meeting this coming Monday or next Monday. Yeah, it's going to be a real meeting at the original Oyster House, okay?
Who is we?
Common Sense Campaign, thank you. And so we can probably do something like that, you know, not necessarily in our regular meeting format, but we'll just put together a special meeting and see if we can't, maybe you know some experts who can help us formulate this and kick it around a little bit. I mean, of course, I mean, we're under pressure now because you've got, you know, the time with what's going on up in Montgomery, but let's just talk about it and see if we can't come up with a time to do something like that. You want to try to do that?
That would be great, and I'd appreciate whatever feedback you could have. Again, everybody that I talk to says, yes, in those certain circumstances, I'd like for folks to have access to the meds. We want it tightly controlled, but how do you control it without somebody to control it? And that's an additional bureaucracy. So I'm open to the solutions and ideas y'all may have.
Okay. We're running out of time, but I know Miss Laurie is going to be very generous for a few minutes. She's looking quite skeptical. All right, so let me just ask you this. I know that I've asked before about the hydroxychloroquine resolution. You've mentioned that the doctors up there don't seem to be too working together. I do understand that Senator Melson is a doctor, and he's actually prescribing hydroxychloroquine. So where do you think I should go with this as far as trying to move this along with your help?
I think Melson would be my answer. You know, of course, he's not the only MD in the Senate and certainly not the MD in the entire legislature. But I have found that Melson, of course, the author of this medical marijuana bill that we were just talking about,
yeah. And
an MD doing something that has to do with medicine, I think is a good thing. But I would, if he's prescribing it, as you say, then I would encourage you to talk to him and see if he'd be willing to carry that. I have not heard that, but again, that would be the place I'd start. The members respond a whole lot more favorably to a professional or somebody in that profession carrying a resolution that has to do with that profession, and I would start there.
Okay. Let me ask you about a sanctuary state amendment that basically protects our people against the radical left and encroachment on some of our rights, specifically gun rights. You know that the crazies are out there, Beto O'Rourke, they want to take your guns. So I know Arizona, I think I've mentioned this to you before, did you get something from Eagle Forum that basically outlined how to deal with this in a bill form?
I did, and I think that before the end of the session, you'll see some movement on that to make that happen here in Alabama. You know, of course, the feds don't care one way or the other what kind of resolutions or amendments we pass. You know, they talk about supremacy clause and everything else, that they've got the right to enforce it. I go back to, you know, one of the reasons we have a right to bear arms is to check the power, the ultimate check, if you will, the power of the federal government, and I think Alabamians are going to use that if it comes to it. But in the meantime, I do think you'll see some movement on a sanctuary amendment.
Okay. Well, I guess the real question would be, I mean, in terms of your sense of how is the session moving, are you going to have enough time to get the things done that you want to get done, or we're going to be sort of in a pickle about, you know, making sure that the key things get done, or are we talking maybe about a special session or anything like that?
Well, I think the answer to that is both. One, we're just a little under a third of the way through the session now. Things are my priorities are moving along, and I'm pretty pleased with that, out of the Senate and then the House. That happened very quickly. Of course, the House moves a little slower, but I'm glad that things are moving along. I think that these other matters we've talked about, there's still plenty of time to work on. You asked about a special session, and I do absolutely think there will be a special session, if not more than one. We'll have to continue to deal with the redistricting, and those numbers coming out of the Biden administration have been slowed down significantly. We may not have redistricting and census data numbers for redistricting until the fall, which will provide an interesting challenge to get redistricting done in time for the upcoming election.
Right. Well, Senator Elliott, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's been very instructive, and I hope that those issues that we talked about that you need some help with will certainly push people down here to get in touch with you and others in the Mobile area, and I'll try to support you through the Alabama Conservative Coalition, through our various members, and do what we can do to move things along. So thank you again. Godspeed. You take care, and best to your family.
Thanks, Dr. Lou. Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Take care.
Chris,
bye-bye.
Good to hear from you.
Well, Miss Lori, here we are.
A fast half hour.
A very fast half hour, and I want to thank you for giving me 4 extra minutes. I look out. I know the bill is coming next week. All right. Well, all right, folks, here we are. You know, as I said at the beginning of this, you know, the political report at the national level to me is just in the pits, okay? It's depressing. On the state level, there are some signs of positive things happening. But we've got to stay on top of these things to make sure that whatever you think you need to have done in Montgomery, they know about what your desires are. So if you'll go to the commonsensecampaign.org website or Facebook, you can find it. You'll see some of these issues out there, and ask you to call and follow up and do what you can do to assist us and everyone else in making sure that the good legislation is actually passed. So on that note, y'all have a great week. Let's hope for some good weather. I don't know what else we can hope for except for good weather and good health. There
Very
we are.
Good.
Larry,
thank you.
You take care. Y'all
thank
be
you.
Good. Bye.
Mm-hmm. You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campomenosi. This program is paid for by Spriggs Enterprises, featuring the Shell gas stations in Daphne on Highways 98 and 90, and in Malbus on 181. This is a paid-for program. The opinions and views expressed are not necessarily those of this station. WABF, resuming regular programming.